Even experienced home cooks can find buying and cooking beef to be a daunting task. Beef is expensive. It comes in many grades and many cuts, and it's far too easy to ruin a good steak. That's where John Turode comes in. He's the chef of Smith's of Smithfield in London, and he's written an informative cookbook on the subject called Beef and Other Bovine Matters. It's published by Taunton Press. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hello.
G'day.
G'day, which would reveal to people that although you have a restaurant in London, you are an Australian.
I'm an Aussie, absolutely.
Now, most cookbooks cover a variety of central ingredients, but your book is all about just beef. Are there enough different ways to prepare beef to require a whole cookbook?
Yeah, I think the thing is that you know, as you say, people are quite frightened of it, and it is an expensive thing. And what I've tried to do is to cover the whole subject with all the cuts. So there's beef, there's veal, but also we forget that actually the great Christmas pudding is made from suet, which came from beef anyway. So I did a little sweet section as well. So there's like a classic couple of desserts in there called, you know, spotted dick and jam roly poly.
Now, these are all English things and some Australian things. Can I assume that you probably don't know what proportion of the average American's diet is made up of beef?
I would have no idea.
I suspect that it probably is higher than in Britain and elsewhere, because we have become much we have a large vegetarian population. But I think we probably eat proportionally more per capita more beef than any other people in the world. But I was wondering if the British are the best people to consult about the preparation of beef. Isn't steak and kidney pie a mainstay of British cuisine?
No, I think there's a sort of major, you know, change in what's happened in Britain. And it's happened because of the influx of people like me from other places. I think, you know, Australians have come in, South Africans have come in, a large Italian and Greek population have come into England, Indian population. So there's a sort of very much multicultural world going on.
And although the Indians are not going to eat beef.
No, of course. But, you say that, but, you know, I think there's a, you know, massive influence in the way which people cook. And what's happened now is that there is this world which is suddenly exploding in good food. Let's remember that Britain went through an industrial revolution. And when that happened, people stopped eating great food. And what's happened in the last 20 years, especially in central London, is that food has become an extraordinary thing and a focus. And that's great. But also, what I've tried to do is to explain to people that there are some great original British breeds of beef. And they have different flavours. And that's why, as a, you know, somebody who lives in Britain, I think that British beef is some of the best in the world.
You also include some of the British meat traditions, meat pies and pasties. There are a number of recipes here for that. Well, so since you're talking about British beef, how does an American adjust to that when we're using this cookbook?
No changes whatsoever. What I've done in the book itself is, if you actually open up the book, which you should have in front of you,
I do,
and you take the cover off. And if you take that cover off and then you open it up, inside is a beef chart. Mm-hmm. And that beef chart will tell you every single cut that comes from the animal itself. And then that shows you in American terms, in American butchery, exactly how it all works.
Because this is where people get most confused. They go to the shop, they go to the meat counter, and they see a whole bunch of different cuts. All of it looks pretty much the same, and one costs a lot more than the next.
Yeah, well, I think this is the other thing I want to try and get across in the book. There's two really big points with beef for me. First one is that we've got to understand that it's a big animal, and the muscles that do all the work, so the legs and all the things that walk around a lot, and the neck that goes up and down and feeds, are tougher cuts of meat, which they need long, slow cooking. And the bits that don't do very much work cook very quickly, like a steak. The other thing I want to try and get across is, if you buy a piece of meat and it's bright red all the way through, it's not a very good piece of meat. It needs little bits, flecks of white, little bits of marbling in it. And that melts as it starts to cook. And that makes the meat succulent and tasty and full of flavor.
That's the fat that gives it flavor.
Yeah, but that's the fat that's been laid down in the muscle. And what I try and compare this with is an athlete. An athlete has no fat in their muscle. Now, that's a very, very lean, stringy person. You think about eating that, and it's quite hard. Whereas you think about somebody who's actually got a good diet and has a little bit of fat laid down their muscle, they're a succulent, lovely, cuddly thing.
Well, you aren't saying that those tougher cuts of meat are worse. They're just different because some of those tough cuts of meat have a lot of flavor to them, don't they?
Well, the ones that do all the muscles that do all the work, which actually needs long, slow cooking, have all the flavor. That's where all the flavor is. A piece of shin, a piece of shank, a piece of chuck, for instance, they're the bits of meat you want to be eating, and you want to cook them long and slow, lots of potatoes, and stretch it out. And if in these times when people have little money, the idea of a big pot of food which feeds a family or can give two or three meals is a way to go, and it's a great way to cook.
Would you prefer, let's say you were cooking a steak, would you prefer that the bone would be in or that it would be boneless?
Well, I think the idea of cooking a rib with a bone in, there is actually nothing better at all. It's one of the most beautiful pieces of meat in the world. But when you get to the sirloin and you get to the rump, you can't have the bone in all the time. But let's just remember the great T-bone steak. The T-bone steak is the top end of the rump with a piece of fillet attached and a bone down the center. That is a prize piece of meat.
Let's talk about aging, because we hear that the best beef is aged. If I leave a cut of meat in the refrigerator for more than a few days, it starts to smell bad.
Well, yes, because I think this is where the misapprehension is about aging. Aging is about a whole or a half a body of meat which has been hung up, separated from everything else, in a big cool room at about 7 degrees and letting the natural bacteria break down the meat. Now, there's two ways of aging meat. There is a wet aging, which is done in a large plastic bag, and there's dry aging. And dry aging is basically hanging it on the bone and let all the bacteria do the work. Now, that is prize meat, but it's very, very expensive. And look, I understand we've all got to think about what we spend. So that was the whole idea of the beef book, is that you actually can get good quality meat and you don't, you know, can buy it from a store and a supermarket.
Well, in some countries, people eat every little part of the cow, the pig, the sheep, whatever, the chicken, the duck. In the United States, we probably eat less of it, for one. But you go to France, for example, and the best restaurant will have trotters. In this country, people resist that, tripe, resist all sorts of organ meats.
Yeah, I think the offal has become something which people are really, really frightened of. And I understand it. But, you know, you go to Thailand and all offal from all animals is reserved for the royalty because there's only one liver, there is only one heart. And of course, you know, to slaughter a whole animal and to have a small amount of this richness is quite a treat. And I think it's just the fact that we don't know how to cook it, or we're slightly frightened of it, or we've had the experience of 20 years ago where it's been cooked badly.
My guest is John Torode, T-R-O-D-E. He is one of the people on a BBC TV series called MasterChef. Has his own restaurant in London called Smith's of Smithfield, and now a book called Beef and Other Bovine Matters, which is published by Taunton. Do you talk mostly about beef on your TV show?
No, MasterChef is a competition.
This is like Top Chef in this country?
Well, Top Chef, I believe you guys have professionals. What we use is we have amateur cooks from all around the country. We start off with 134 contestants. 8 weeks later, every single night, we actually whittle them down to one champion. And they go through all sorts of extraordinary challenges. And we do a celebrity version as well. So we've done that for 5 years, just been recommissioned for another 3 years. So I'm around for a little bit longer, which is good.
Does the animal's quality of life or death affect the quality of the meat?
Well, husbandry is really important, and the fact that it's breed, how it's being treated, the feed it eat, of course, that attributes to the flavor. As far as what happens at the end of its life, that is seriously important. It needs to be a kind person who makes sure that animal's lovely and calm, and then that's it. It ends its life, and then it's looked after and it's nurtured.
Because otherwise, when they bash them over the heads as they did under the worst of circumstances, adrenaline flows through the body. Does that affect the taste of the meat?
Adrenaline, lactic acid, rigor mortis sets in too fast, the animal becomes tense. Of course, that all affects it. And why would you want a farmer to spend 3 years breeding an animal and then suddenly for somebody to turn around and mess it up because they were being impatient?
Many years ago, I did ads for supermarket, and we used to say corn-fed beef, as though that was the best kind of beef. Now it's grass-fed beef.
Well, yeah, the reason you use corn is to give protein, and protein builds up muscle. But what that was very, very fast growing, quick maturing beef. What we're talking about, you're talking about grass-fed beef, is that it spends a lot of time having a nice life. It wanders around. It has the sun set, the sunrise. It, you know, has the pastures. It has a great fun life.
And don't cows eat grass naturally? They don't eat corn.
They eat grass naturally, of course, but they also eat barley. They eat wheat. They eat all sorts of things. But corn, I don't know if they'd eat corn. Chickens would eat corn.
What about Kobe beef, which is very expensive? Is it really better, or isn't it tender because they actually are forced into sedentary lives?
Well, I think in a way it's as probably as controversial as what was going on with veal many years ago. I don't necessarily think it's that good. The idea of feeding an animal beer all day, it might be nice to serve your mates beer, but the idea of an animal, I don't know, and they massage
even
it.
Even if they give it Fosters?
Well, see, you know, I'm not very good with Fosters. Victoria Bitter, that's good. You know, actually, I much prefer to, you know, go down and have a couple of Coors Lights, and I'd be happy with that. Thanks very much.
You support the Rare Breed Survival Trust. What does that do?
The Rare Breed Society Trust is a trust which has been brought together about the rarest breeds of animals. Now, let's remember that we talk about rare breeds. The only reason they continue to be a single breed is because we continue to keep their bloodline going. That means we have to keep on eating them. So the Rare Breed Society Trust makes sure that we have purebred animals like the White Park, for instance. The White Park is a grand, great beast, which apparently, whilst it was being eaten one day by King James, was knighted to become the sirloin. Before that, it was just the loin.
Now, people can mess up even the most simple process, like grilling a steak. I've heard people say that you shouldn't put the salt on the steak before because it'll toughen it. What do you think?
Well,
others say you should put steak on a cast iron pan. Just put the steak onto the pan, and that will caramelize it.
Well, the meat won't caramelize. It goes through something called Maillard reaction, which has got to do with proteins and changing color. The deal is with a steak, there's very simple rules. Get your pan or your griddle pan, whatever you want to do, very, very, very hot. Make sure that there's, where the steak is, there's a layer of fat, and sitting underneath that layer of fat is a small piece of sinew. Put a little snip in that, because that sinew will tighten up like an elastic band and make your steak tough. Put oil on your meat first before you put the salt and pepper on, because the salt will draw some water out. But that's it. Oil, then your salt, then your pepper. Pepper is a spice. The spice needs to heat to explode to get flavor. And then it goes into that searing hot pan, and it's got to make a noise. 2 minutes each side. That's it.
So you don't have to cut into it to see if it's red. Of course, one person's done. Is the next person's too raw?
Yeah, and I think that's right. And that's why I think we're talking before about beef on a bone. A rib steak on the bone, cooked whereby you've got the outside is well done, then the next bit is medium rare, then medium, then you end up with the center being really rare. It's all things for all people. That's the best way to eat meat.
And then you say we should let it rest. Why?
Well, you let it rest just because it's been really dancing in the pan and all those bits of water are, you know, going all over the place. It just needs to settle down a little bit. And if you just let it rest for a minute or two, it will cut a lot better and eat a lot better.
Now, there are some terms I saw in this book that I've never heard before, like carpetbag steak and bull tongue.
Well, carpetbag steak is an Australian, a great Australian thing, where you take a fillet and then you put a pocket in it and you put oysters in the middle and the oyster water, and that oyster water is like salt water, so that's the seasoning inside the steak. That's wrapped in bacon, and then when you cut into the steak, you've got flavour of oysters and beef. Biltong is dried beef jerky, which is, the South Africans do it, and all it is beef which has been dried out till it's very, very crisp.
Now, one of the most popular ways to cook beef in this country is barbecue, but you don't do much of that in this book.
Well, no, I do. I talk about grilling, but I talk about grilling very, 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 very gently. I think the thing about barbecue is sometimes it's really aggressive. I think if you're going to do a barbecue, light your wood and your coals and do what you want to do, then let it go till it starts out, it's glowing, and then let it cook slowly. Don't, if you think about something hitting very, very hot flame, or, you know, it will just curl up and shrink and go tough. And the other thing is, why spend so much money for the flavor of that beautiful beef to be masked by the flavor of smoke? And it's sometimes that smoke's acrid, you know, really acidic. You want it just to be lovely, mellow flavor of beef.
You write that restaurant recipes belong in a restaurant. Mm. So these are recipes that you would make at home, or are they adapted with the home in mind?
No, not at all. These are recipes that come really from my life, cooking in my home kitchen, or inspired by my, you know, grandmother or my, you know, Nana Hinky, who was my uncle's mother, who was a white Russian, who, for instance, gave me the pelmeni recipe when I was like 6 years old. The idea of these are recipes that people do at home, because I don't want people to be stressed about it. But saying that, there are challenging recipes in there, but they are done in such a way that they're for people to cook at home, because I think go to the restaurant, let somebody else cook for you. That's what you're paying for. Don't do it yourself.
Recently, there have been a lot of studies about the environmental impact of eating beef. A recent study by the Dalhousie University in Canada claims that beef is responsible for 78% of the emissions produced by livestock production. So should we be feeling guilty about eating beef?
Well, you can do one of two things. You can say, okay, fine, we're going to stop eating beef, but that we will still keep on drinking milk, we'll still keep on eating cheese, and the fact is, for a dairy industry to continue, we've got to have a female animal which produces milk and a male animal, which, of course, they are born at the same ratio, 1-to-1. So what are you going to do? You're just going to get rid of the male animals and not use them? No, grow them up and eat them.
A caller, you have to give this answer very quickly, says he ate milk guts in Australia. What are milk guts?
No idea. I know what milk bottles are, the little tiny sweets. No idea what milk guts are. They sound like udders.
We are told that only people in Argentina eat more beef than people in this country. Most of the breeds in this country actually come out of England, don't they?
They do, because out of Argentina, it's what's called Bos Equis, which basically is the breed that comes out of India, and then the Canonina animal, which is down in Argentina and Brazil.
John Turow's book, Beef and Other Bovine Matters, is published by Taunton, and it's beautifully illustrated as well. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.